Senator Skoy pointed out that we forgot to, even though we couldn't find the money for multiple points of use, yet we did not adopt the language. So if we want to consider paying for it later. So Senator Skoy, I can't read this.
Yes.
Can I get my glasses?
Madam Chair, there was the A119 amendment discussed, and then we realized that it had a fiscal impact that we were uncomfortable with, so we withdrew the whole thing without adopting the amendment. We should adopt the language, and then we will discuss the provision later on. So I would move the A119 amendment to the multiple points provision.
Ms. Pollack and Ms. McQuaid, do you have that? We're just doing the language, not the money.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
Ms.
Pollack, was that you who said?
Madam Chair, yes. I have the amendment.
Okay,
or the
great.
Language and the
Thank
motion
you.
To adopt the language and holding the money issue aside.
Yes. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, can you say where that is in side-by-side?
Ms. Dalton, where is that in the side-by-side? Do you know?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. It's around page 58, I want to say.
Round 58, she wants to say.
No, actually, it's...
Page 54 on the House side. Yes, page 54.
Madam Chair, that's where it is.
And it's amending... I know we went over it, but it's amending the House language, or it's just an amendment, period?
It's amending the House file.
House Madam Chair, Senator Rust, it is essentially, it's based primarily on the Senate language, but it's deleting the whole section and replacing it with all new language.
So it's both,
okay. Everybody got that? This is the language the Department of Revenue likes, too?
Madam Chair, I'm on page 58, and what's the section?
54.
54, bottom of the page.
Right. Good reason. Thank you.
Okay.
Section 7.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. Thank you. And Senator Chair Skoy and I were talking just now and briefly in the hall, and what we thought would be a good use of time. And we know the Senate's had a day like the House usually has. So we were watching you go on and off the floor. And so it's too bad we couldn't get back together this afternoon, but it just didn't work out because you all had a lot going on in the Senate. We actually had a shorter day. But we were thinking maybe 45 minutes about on these development issues. We want to hear a little bit more from Representative Norton and Senator Senjum on thoughts on the DMC and the commissioner and anybody else. And we want to just more questions on any of them, 3M, the mall, Baxter, whatever people have on their mind, just so we can get any issues out there so we can talk about those. And then we did want to kind of get through the tobacco just to understand the differences in the two bills before we adjourn tonight. And then if there's some time, we were going to go back to some of the Senate items, and if not, we'll just... stop for the night. So
that sounds real good, Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy, do you have a time frame of when you'd like to adjourn by? I'm a fan of having goals.
Well, I'm looking at the staff, but I don't really care. Whenever you want, Madam Chair.
I'm a night owl, and I get up early, so I'm no problem staying here as late as it takes, but I don't think the Senate and House staff are as effective when they don't sleep.
Maybe 10:30 would be good.
Okay. So 10 to 10:30 is our goal. Does that work for the conferees, Commissioner?
Right.
You know, you're late, but I heard you're on time tonight. Is that right, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, I am on time tonight, and I'm a little concerned about that because I know a lot of people in the audience preferred for me to be consistent. And so now I'm being inconsistent by being on time,
yes.
So I'm sorry.
10:30 work for the department? Okay, so 10:30, Mr. Chair.
I did get a cup of fresh coffee, so I probably just hang in there pretty well.
Okay. Okay, so to all the development items, Representative Norton or Senator Senjum, do you want to queue up any things we should be thinking about, Mayo, or any conferees, or the commissioner, or anybody? I think just any issues that we should get out there a little more. We kind of ended abruptly. Or Chair Skoy or anyone, thoughts? Representative Norton.
Well, I had just one thing I'm just going to throw out here that's not in either plan, but as we were listening to some discussion earlier today, you had an exemption granted for competitive bidding on a couple other projects.
Can you pull your mic up just a tad? Thank you.
The issue of an exemption for competitive bidding on projects that might have a joint purpose from the private development and part of the infrastructure, and I think that might be something we might want to think about as we move forward, because the example that was given was parking ramps, and we are going to be having a number of private development that is anticipated to come into town that may well have that type of need for a public parking structure in combination. So I just would like to throw that out there. I know it's not in either bill, but maybe we could think about that in the future moving ahead as well.
I think that's a good issue. I hadn't thought of that. I don't know how people feel about that. I'll tell you, when we first started, because it's in the bill as it relates to the Bloomington project, and when we first started talking about it, my reaction was that it would be something that organized labor would oppose. In fact, I learned that's not accurate, but I would encourage folks to talk to Mr. Melander, who's in the room, and others if they have an interest in this provision. They're fairly typical, is my understanding. And we just really don't want it confused with, and I see Mr. Macarios is there too, we don't want it confused with some of the things when people think of being exempted from bidding. You think, well, that's some attempt, that's something labor would not like, and that's not what this item is. And that was talked about a little bit. Mr. Michael walked through it. It's fairly typical on the mall provision. So I hadn't thought about that for the Rochester. Does anyone have any questions on that one? Do we want to go back to Mr. Michael to kind of have everyone understand what that is, or does everyone get that? Okay. Other things on DMC, Senator Senjum, or Representative Norton, or, you know, maybe we should just talk about what we think sticking points might be. We're certainly not completely there. So, Senator Scoy?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that from my perspective, the major issue we have to resolve is who sells the bonds and if it's going to be the city or the authority. And I think that's unresolved at this point. I think the House has the city, and we have taken a different track on that. I think that, you know, I don't know that we view this aid the same. I think that because it's not traditional aid, it's an overburden aid, that the state is going to need to play a more significant role in it, and hence the makeup of the authority board, where we have state members and a combination of local members. And we did a fair amount of thought on this, and we think that it's important to balance that board out, and we picked an even number so that it would actually require a two-vote margin to move provisions forward. It's not like anybody can run projects through without support, but it would be kind of a check, is the way we viewed it. And we think that that's a pretty good mechanism, and we think it's a pretty good place to be the main mechanism for this to function. I know, Senator Rest, worked on this today some.
Yeah,
so.
And also, we're persuaded about this authority that we have, the board, that the city needs to have a more active role, not only in the EDC that we'll be proposing, but in the approval at almost every point. So that we thought was a very important thing to move toward, and so you'll see that in our language that'll be forthcoming.
Okay. So, Chair Scoy, can I just ask? So you're intending to bring some new language forward?
Yes.
Okay. Because, you know, one thing I was going to ask in thinking about this is maybe asking Ms. Pollack, but if it's moot now because new language is coming forward, you know, in the discussion this morning and listening to what Senator Senjum and you and Senator Rest said, and then, you know, you heard Representative Norton and I and Representative Danny, you know, we don't see anywhere in your bill that the city has any control over this.
They will.
And it was asserted that the Senate bill has that, and we could not find it. I mean, we left, and we're convinced we're right.
It wasn't in there.
Okay.
As of tomorrow morning, it's in there.
So we were right at that moment.
You were right at that point in time.
You should have looked so hard.
I do think one thing that's helpful is if everyone's got language changes on provisions in the bill, we need to get them out. And at this moment, I'll just tell you, the House has none. So on anything, the House is standing behind its bill. So, Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, and we were very concerned in order to make our approach work, that the bond issuance not be attributable to the state's cap. And so one of the other things we've been doing today is working very hard to structure the provisions in the bill so that they'll pass muster with MMB and with the state's bond council, we have found a way of doing that, and we're still working through that, quite frankly.
Okay.
Well, you can't just say it doesn't have any impact. You have to provide for it not having any impact, and so we think we're there, but we're very, very cognizant of that and don't want to jeopardize the city's bond rating, our bond rating, or the cap. So we're working very hard on that.
Okay. Chair Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we thought we might have language for tonight, but it'll be tomorrow morning. So we'll get that to you as soon as we have language. Senator Rest did touch on this, but we think that what we're – and it's hard to talk about language when you don't have it. But just as a concept, where we're heading is for the city to have approval of the plan, the overall planning that's going on, that they would have approval, another bite at the apple in the land use plan mechanism. And then, as Senator Rest indicated, we're trying to thread a needle to see if we can get them involved in the development of the plan more. And that was one of the things that we spent a fair amount of time on today. Just the senators and Senate staff was meeting this afternoon.
Okay. And so, Representative Norton or Senator, I mean, I guess hearing that, you know, remember, I don't know how the testimony played out in the Senate, but when we heard the bill in the House, we were told repeatedly that this is not for the mail. These are municipal projects. And if that's the case, it's the city who should be in charge. So I just, you can't have it both ways.
But part, Madam Chair, part of the...
Maybe that's not what the testimony was in the Senate, but I will tell you in the House it was told over and over again. None of these are for mail. These are for the city. It's all municipal structures, and how the city should not be the big player there is difficult for me to understand. And Chair Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there was discussion about the infrastructure being for the city of Rochester to help them grow as fast as mail is growing. But part of the financing is private investment coming into the medical center.
To Mayo.
Well, Mayo and other medical facilities. And so when that is going on, we thought it was appropriate that they would have some role to play. And I think we're actually proposing that they be one of the responsible parties for the bond payment. If for some reason things go south, that they would have be one of the signatories, start being responsible for the bond payments.
Well, I mean, I'll just tell you and ask Representative Norton to jump in on her thoughts and Senator Senjum, but, you know, from my perspective, the Mayo part, the private money, they should do whatever they want with their money. And we shouldn't really have any say in that. And, in fact, the House bill says if you use private money to hire your consultant, we don't really care what you pay them and what you're doing with it. If you use the public subsidy from the state, you know, we're interested. So I think there's a lot of latitude, and if it's really private money being invested in Mayo here and then the state and the county and the city here, that's where I think the locally elected officials should be reviewing that. And it sounds like we're getting a little closer than from the bills introduced.
And it's concept at this point in terms of the discussion, because you don't have our new or revised language, if you will. But you know, I think you might well be interested in the approach we take, and the increased role of the city with regard to those. That's not in the current thing here.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Just real briefly, it's hard to separate out the infrastructure from the surrounding area at some point. I mean, this stuff is all going to work together. And it's one of the things that if I've listened to folks from all sides of this issue that has just occurred to me. If they don't get along and work on this thing collaboratively, it probably isn't going to work. So they're going to have to do that. And we need to figure out a mechanism to make that happen.
Representative Norton, and I think, you know, you may want to throw in here so senators understand that the concept we're talking about absolutely has Mayo and the business community and a gubernatorial point. There's a lot going on here. It's not city versus Mayo here. Ours is a multifaceted approach as well. But we do have the city being the gatekeeper, since that's how you can hold some elected officials accountable. But Representative Norton and then Senator Senjum, we'd like to hear from you.
Well, I really appreciate what Senator Scoy was saying, and that I think it's the same thing we were saying earlier today, is in order for this to be successful, we need to set it up as a partnership from the beginning, so that the plans develop together with the city and Mayo from day one, and we don't get down the road and have something vetoed that, you know, is well along the way. So I agree with that concept, and the House, I think, is set up. You know, we like our plan. We've been working on it for a very long time. Trying to get something that is that happy medium, and maybe you have some suggestions.
So have we been working
that
on
you
a long
will
time.
Have some things that maybe we can blend together and get just the right thing. One of the questions I had about the Senate plan, is it all right?
Yes, please.
That's been some bit of consternation, I think, with some of us in the discussion, is you have set up two levels of authority. You have the corporation, then the city will approve the plans, and then you have the authority that's a step up further. And the House has condensed all that into just the corporation and the city then kind of granting approval to access the funds. Can you talk a little bit more about your thinking on that? Because it was quite different than the House.
And, Madam Chair, this has been an evolving discussion. But I think that the corporation or the authority will be where the state has its say in all this money. And we need to get consistent on the language so that I'm talking. But it's the one with the state board. Now, with regard to this lower-level planning committee, there would be experts in economic development and other aspects of, you know, development that would do the groundwork, develop the plans, and that's the area where we're trying to figure out if we can't work the city more involved with that, because we think that it's important that these plans develop in conjunction with everybody, and so that the city just doesn't get something dumped on their lap at some point that they can only say yes or no to. And so that's part of what we're trying to figure out now. But we envision that organization as being a real a group of individuals that have a lot of expertise in this area, doing a lot of the work to make this thing happen. And then the city, has input into that. But they have the final approval of the plans that that group would be developing.
Madam Chair,
Representative Norton, please.
For clarification, we're going to have consultants, people hired doing the work, and it's really the important part of what's going to happen, the vision of what's going to happen. Who do those employees answer to in your model?
Well, they would answer to the corporation, which is a coalition of private and public and individuals. Mayo would be part of it. I think City of Rochester would be part of it. And then the funding would come from the authority to them. Is that correct, Senator Rest?
Yep.
Representative Norton?
Yeah, and I really appreciate that. And I think we're not that far apart, really, on our thinking in this. We have a board in our economic development because we wanted this partnership, and that was one way we could do it. And I think rather than the authority saying it's the money is a go, it's the city saying, you know.
Sure.
And
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, as I've looked through some of the House provisions, you grant the city the authority, a port authority. And we are viewing this as kind of a port authority.
Right.
I mean, so the authorities are very similar. Mm-hmm. And if we can figure out how to make that operate and function, I think we can get there, hopefully.
Yeah, that's true. Representative Norton, did you want to just tell the senators what your composition, who are these people who sit on the House's authority or nonprofit?
The economic development
Yeah,
who are, nonprofit.
Because I think, be interesting to know. They're similar.
We had several employees from Mayo. We had the mayor, represented from the city council, represented from the county board, a business representative, and a labor representative.
So, you know, Mayo's well represented.
Well, and Madam Chair, I'll tell you in my gut tells me on this that a smaller board is better. And I thought a six-person board was the way to go. I thought that the locals would have three representatives, the state would have three, would kind of force them to, you know, figure this all out collaboratively. Now I understand that there's some that some people would prefer a little larger board, a little more representation to the city. So what was in our original bill was eight members, four from the state, two from the city, one from the county, and one from Mayo. And so we're,
can we establish a super majority to even have a quorum? So it would not at any point be the possibility that there would not be someone there from the local government.
And well, the other thing, we thought that the members of the board would elect their own chairman out of the state appointees. It's kind of what we thought would make that work pretty well.
In the bill that you have before you, the governor appoints the chair?
Yeah, we're making some changes to that.
Change that to let them choose their own chair. Or we are proposing to do
that. That's what we're going to propose tomorrow.
Okay. I want to hear from Senator Senjum if we can more on this. But I want to ask someone from House Counsel to and I don't know if it's Mr. Hines or Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michael, but just trying to think of all these authorities. You know, we have, 20-some port authorities in Minnesota. Can anyone inform us, because these authorities, this is part of the reason I'm having a problem with this, because we've got very sophisticated groups doing this across the state, and they're doing a great job. And we're not asking the state to step in and do their work for them in these other cities. So, I do think that the way it would play out is both the city and the Mayo would hire new people, probably with either Mayo, who they're comfortable with now as they go through their plan, and the city would probably do a national search for a new Port Authority Administrator or an Authority Administrator. So, you'd get some top talent to take over this multi-year complicated project. And so can House staff tell us generally what are the makeups of these parallel bodies and what are their sizes? And I know they're all different, and not a bunch of us have sat on them in our communities, but I'm talking about sort of the bigger player port authorities in the state. You know, they tend to be Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, Duluth. I mean, there's a lot of smaller ports, but there's only a handful of cities that really...
The Vikings authority.
Yeah. That's a little... But, I mean, that was a statewide resource. And, you can bring up the IRRRB, but that's really not what we're talking about. I mean, that's one field. It's not developing a city, basically, is what's getting built here. Right? That's how Mayo has sold it to us, is that the city can't really build this big new city that it needs to accommodate it. So it's not like putting certainly with all due respect to the people who are getting the Viking Stadium done, once that's done, it's done. I mean, this isn't a, multiple-year project with multiple buildings and, all kinds of infrastructure going in with multiple levels of government. But the cities who are doing it, let's take Minneapolis or St. Paul or Bloomington or Duluth, what do those authorities... that's what I would ask the staff. What do those authorities generally look like? And I see Ms. Dyson is here, too. So anybody, if you can tell us the group that already have these port authorities or whatever you want to call them going, EDAs, and I'm not talking about the little ones, what do they look like as a rule?
Madam Chair, the Duluth Port Authority is a unique, or the Seaway Port Authority is a unique entity, and that's sort of separate by itself from the other ones in the sense that it's got gubernatorial appointees on its board and so forth. But otherwise, the port authorities, which is not really what the House is, it's not the model that the House's bill follows at all, but port authorities, typically have five or seven member boards. and those boards are selected by the cities that constitute those port authorities, and they're entities that are under the direct control of the city. In some cases, it's also similar for economic development authorities and HRAs. Some cities elect to have council members make up most of the members of those authorities. Other cities choose to appoint other individuals who the city decides are more expert in managing port authorities and so forth. But port authorities generally are entities that are under the control of the city, whereas what the Senate bill has envisioned is more of an independent entity that's, in part got more like the Duluth model, where it's got gubernatorial appointees and is independent, whereas what the House is doing is sort of creating a corporation that's largely invested with the task of doing the planning for this and developing the plan and modifying the plan and providing expertise, but it's the city actually that's expected to implement and make the decisions on, when debt will be issued, what spending, what projects will go forward at what time and so forth, subject to whatever this, whatever the plan is that the corporation adopts. So it's, but port authorities, economic development authorities, and HRAs generally are bodies that are controlled by the cities. They have different, different sizes of boards, and some of them are essentially the city councils and others are not.
And I understand the Duluth, which I think is a little different, and I personally am not a big fan, Senator Scoy, I'll just tell you that. But, if you look at the Minneapolis situation in St. Paul, Bloomington's not a good measure there, but, they're certainly getting a lot of money from the state every year, but we're not asking some state hybrid board to make decisions as they do developments in their communities. So, Senator Scoy.
And thank you, and Madam Chair, I looked at what happened along the port and the lakefront of Duluth, and I actually was thinking about how that port authority had done such a good job of doing development in the city of Duluth, and in my mind I was kind of thinking about that when we were setting this up, to be honest with you, and I thought it worked pretty well. And I looked at this, as you say, there are other port authorities that do get state dollars, but pretty significant amount of state contribution here, and I just thought it was good to have a little state oversight trying to ensure that, the state money going in, and it's significant, is well spent.
I think Representative Norton has a state component.
I wanted to clarify that.
There is state oversight, Representative Norton.
I did want to clarify that because I named seven of the nine members. We have a nine-member board in ours. You have an eight-member board, so they really aren't that far apart in your authority. And we have two gubernatorial appointees. You have several as well, but they're not to be from the city. So they really are only one person apart.
Getting closer. So Senator Scoy, then Senjum, then Dabney.
Well, I think that this in the last version of our board, the city has a quarter of the representation. Mayo would have an eighth, and the county would have an eighth, and the state would have half. Oh. So that is different than two out of nine.
Yes. Senator Senjum, what are you thinking about all this?
I think Destination Medical Center is wonderful, and we need to get it done.
We know you think that. I think that's why you're here.
And, Madam Chair, I also think I think we generally maybe closer than we feel or understand in terms of conversation, but maybe not as close as we can or will be certainly in written language, and we just need to kind of get there. But I think we're all kind of visualizing this in the right sort of way, at least conceptually, and I think it's important that we, get something to paper and to the extent that, get as close as we can and then continue to polish on it. But just thinking about it, maybe I expressed some of these thoughts this morning, and we'll just go right all the way back to the beginning. Mayo had this concept of a destination medical center, knowing that as they look at their future, they can't be the same. They've decided that they need to change, and they need to change in a way that's going to make them much bigger, than they are now. Now, has the city and Mayo worked over the years on lots of projects? And if you didn't know it, I worked there 44 years. And I'm not going to count them in front of you, but there's probably 10 to 15 major complex buildings with subway systems and all the intricacies of all the cross ties and utilities and so on that work down there, and to which Mayo has worked with the city over the course of many years to build a pretty intricate complex. And in my mind, that will continue and has to continue. And then so you think about this and you think about what Mayo is coming forward with, they want to build the best, most attractive new medical center in the absolute world that's going to not only attract patients, but once patients come here are going to be very, very satisfied at not only the care that they get, but the community that they're residing in during their care. And that's one of these things about trying to make Rochester more attractive for patient visits. And that's, in my mind at least, the general concept here of Destination Medical Center. And so thinking about that, it seems to me, and again, the city's worked well, Mayo's worked well, but now we're thinking about this brand new, colossal, wonderful, awesome medical destination to which we want to bring people to. And it seems to me the most motivated party in all of this is Mayo, because, you know, they've got everything at stake in this, including lots and lots of money. But more than that, they're staking their future in Rochester, and they're staking their future in a real good product. And so to me, they ought to be the motivated developer in terms of not only conceptualizing what the future of the Mayo Medical Campus is, but also playing that out from an economic development point of view, all the way from benefactors to design and so on and so forth. And then they work with the city like they have done for 80 years in terms of the approval process, and cities doing what cities do, and Mayo doing what they do best. And then the authority coming in behind and giving it the austere blessing that it needs from the standpoint of paying the bills and moving the project forward. It just seems to me that those three pieces can work together pretty nicely. And we just got to find the language to make that work. That's the way I view this. But I think, again, my point that I really want to make is the city certainly has to be involved, and they are. If you go into the intricacies of the bill, you'll see everything that the authority does has to be in compliance with city ordinances. Well, okay. Read the city ordinances in, and they call for public hearings and planning and zoning commission public hearings, city council meeting public hearings, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of opportunity for city involvement in anything that happens within the medical district that's going to comprise Destination Medical Center. So that's there. I just think we need to kind of fabricate the right language to make these three entities work: the authority, the planning board, the people that, in my mind, do the magic, and then the city that makes the magic work from the standpoint of the public perspective.
And I guess maybe Senator Senjum, I would just ask you to think about this. Do you, and you don't have to answer now, but do you think having an authority in your community, half of which is run by the state, will help this project move along faster and more efficiently, or slower?
I think the speed isn't going to matter. I think it does. The authority, at least as it presented by the Senate's bill, I think gives not only certainly Rochester and all of those folks certainly do input into the process, not only at the authority level, but we're also going to have it at the council ordinance level, public hearings, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to have all that. But it also gives the state stakeholders a little bit more input into the decision-making process it's having in Rochester, and yeah. I think overall that's important.
I would just say, you know, again, I like elected officials being accountable on these things, and not folks who don't live in that community and don't run for office in that community. But I will also say that I hope Mayo will talk to some of the other large developers in the state to see if their experiences that having state involvement helps them or not. And I think Mayo, if they go through that exercise, might be surprised to know that it'll be a monkey on their back, if that's how it plays out, but that's my opinion.
Madam Chair, can I just say?
Yes.
I don't think the authority needs to, and in my view of the vision, I mean, they would never get into, you know, how big a sewer pipe we need or how big that street needs to be, you know, the width of the street or the streetscaping or anything. That's all at the city level. That's all at the development level. In my mind, the authority says, you know what, you've done a good job. We're going to pay the bill, and let's move on to the next project.
But that isn't what the bill says. So just, and we understand there's a new one coming, but the Senate provision does say that you approve the sewer interceptor, so in the authority. So that is, somebody's got to do that, and it's not the city. So we know we're going to get something new. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciated Senator Senjum kind of walking us through a bit of history of 80 years of collaboration between the Mayo and the city that has built a remarkable international resource. But I've also had a lot of opportunity over the years here to think about governance structures. Now, in my slice of life, it's about K-12 education. And I don't know, Senator Dziedzic may remember, this predates her time here, but I know that the chair does. I moved a change in the governance of the Minneapolis Public Schools. Most, not all, school boards in the state are seven members. Ours was challenged. In a number of ways, but part of the challenge was that with at-large elections, one area of the city tended to predominate on the board. And decisions were then made. Maybe the decisions were biased by the geography, maybe they weren't, but the public's trust in those decisions was filtered through a screen that may or may not have been fair, but was real. So I moved through the legislature and then through a public referendum proposal to actually enlarge in the board, to go to nine members and a hybrid board, and I won't bore folks with the details. But the goal there was to make a board that was more reflective of the community and that was more on the ground, so that it was more engaged with the community and the community could be more engaged with the board. That's partially an aside, but not entirely, because what I'm hearing Senator Senjum say is there's a history of collaboration between Mayo and the city.
Oh, huge.
That has worked and has built this. And what I'm seeing in the House language is a board that's one member larger than the current Senate language, and it's sounding like it might be three members larger by morning. But at this point is one member larger, but is much more engaged and reflected the community. And I think that builds on a base of success and reflects different aspects of the community, the business community, the medical community, the elected officials from the city and the county, and then with two gubernatorial appointees, because the state's going to have a lot of money and we should have some folks keeping an eye on that for us. But I think the more local we can make this and the more we can build on the strengths and the experience of Rochester, I would think that would facilitate easier collaboration, better outcomes, while also maintaining, as we do in the House bill, that clear authority of who has to say yes or no at the end at the city with the elected officials.
Commissioner, I don't know if you want to jump in here before we, unless there's something else we need to get out of this. I think we should just put it on the record that the Speaker is very committed to getting this project completed. Senator Baucus and the Governor is, and they're all committed to this. And so, you know, we know we've got to finish this off, but it is the 10 people in this room. Contrary to what people might think sometimes somewhere else, it's the 10 of us who will decide this. How we're actually going to write the bill to get it out of here, to get it signed, And, of course, we're taking input from all these other folks, including the governor and Senator Bach and Representative Thiessen, but we all need to get this done fairly soon. And I don't know, Commissioner, if you want to jump in on governor's view on the project or what you can add to this.
Madam Chair, well, obviously I'll follow up on what Senator Sinjum said. The governor is clearly in support of the project. It has been from the beginning and really has appreciated the work that you've done, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair Skoy, in working through this process to get it to where we are today. I think one of the things that that obviously with the involvement of Tina Smith as Chief of Staff under the directing MMB and Assistant Commissioner Von Mosch from Revenue to support this effort, we're clearly looking forward to trying to find a way that makes this work, both on the local level. You know, I think that the only insight I can really offer at this time until we see the Senate language and we'll work through that is that the governor believes in making things that work and working well and on time and getting things done. But obviously he loves elected officials too, Madam Chair. So I think that is the key, though. It really is working with this environment in a way that gets things done and that both sides are confident that this will get done on time and the people of Minnesota will be proud of this project. So that's really all I can offer at this time. But thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Anything else? Yep. Senator Dietzick, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one thing that I see that you guys don't have, and I don't know if you've thought about, and I know in other port authorities they have language on removal of cause for certain and especially if there's other appointed people.
We're open on that.
Right here, if you have somebody that has it's a crime of some type, especially if it's related to this, there's no language in here on how to remove them.
Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michael, can you comment on that?
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, those sorts of details, this, basically the House bill directs the city to charter a nonprofit corporation, and in the process of doing that, we'll write articles of incorporation and bylaws. And I think those members that crafted this envisioned that when the city does that, they would provide for the manner of removing members of this board. And it may well be that rather than tying your hands so that you can only remove someone who does something that rises to the level of cause, they may in fact want to have more flexibility to remove members of this board for other reasons. So it's certainly conceivable to me that they would say that they serve, for example, a representative from the city council may serve at the pleasure of the city council. And if, for example, that member resigns or no longer is there, they may not want that person to continue serving, but they'd rather be able to replace that person immediately rather than needing to wait till the term is up or to show that there's cause to remove them. So in general, the idea was there'd be more flexibility to allow that to be written into the bylaws and articles of incorporation.
Thank you. So Representative Norton and Dabney. Representative Norton.
While we're on that particular subject, Madam Chair, I wondered, one of the questions that's come up in talking with Mayo Clinic is the difference between a public and a private nonprofit. And some of the concern has been with a public nonprofit, which is the language we currently have in the House, that it may not offer the right environment for benefactors and private donors to give money. And so my question to you would be, is it possible for us to write language that would make it a private nonprofit but still delineate in law, in statute, a board that those staff that are hired would answer to have that partnership early on? So is that possible, or can we not have a say into the makings of a private nonprofit?
Mr. May.
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, what the House bill provides for is the city to charter a nonprofit corporation under Chapter 317A, which is essentially sort of no different than any other nonprofit corporation, except for the fact that the law will impose certain restrictions on this new nonprofit. For example, that they are subject to the Open Meeting Law and the Government Data Practices Act. You, as the legislature, can rewrite those rules any way that you wish. But otherwise, this really is just essentially the equivalent of a private nonprofit, except to the extent that the bill says otherwise.
Representative Martin.
Well, thank you for that. I think given some of the concerns that have been raised about the private donors and how we might incent people to be involved in this economic development tool or that we're developing, they may need a little more privacy than is currently written in with a public nonprofit. And the House has struggled with this mightily, and it's not in here, but I took a part of the bill through civil law in order to get some of the information kept private. I don't think that's enough, frankly, and so I think we have a little bit of work to do if we go down this path with this nonprofit to continue to have what both of our bodies are putting in there, which is establishing a board that is meaningful, that represents the needs of the community and state, but with the privacy that we might need, and it may mean working through very carefully the language so that we can protect the investments that need to be made and still have something open.
Yes, Senator Scoyne.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Norton. I think you're absolutely right, and I think it's important that we have that in place so that the private money flows without worry about disclosure if they're concerned about it. And I just checked briefly with the Senate Council, and we're looking at that also.
And Representative, and I should say, Representative Norton for Senate Conferees has worked so hard on this proposal and knows it better than everyone in this room put together. And Senator Senjum, I'm sure you'd say the same thing about him. Representative Liebling is here. I don't know if you knew she was in here. And we understand the Rochester legislators are working very hard balancing their roles as legislators, their roles as representative of their communities. They have a large employer and, you know, all of us. So it should be noted how hard they've been working on all these details and continue to do that. So they're an asset to us all. So Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the same vein, Mr. Michael, in either of the bills, do the members of the authority, I think I'm asking the question the right way, qualify as public officials?
Mr. Michael.
I'm thinking of issues of conflict of interest.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, are you asking whether they're under Chapter 10A public officials, as that term is defined in Chapter 10A? Because I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to.
And I don't know Chapter 10A.
No. Nah. But there are conflicts of interest rules that are imposed vis-a-vis the conflicts with the, for example, with the medical entity, the Mayo Clinic, and so forth. But Ms. Dyson actually is probably a better one to talk to you about
Ms. Dyson.
Those issues.
Yes, that'd be great. Ms. Dyson.
Members of the conference committee, in the House bill, there is a provision that for conflicts of interest that says that the members of this nonprofit corporation, other than Mayo, cannot be employed by or party to the Mayo Clinic, but it also says that no member may serve as a lobbyist under 10A. So that's the conflict of interest provision in the House bill, and I don't know if the Senate staff may be able to speak to the Senate bill.
Senator Rust.
In the amended language that you'll see tomorrow, we have something that's, I think, identical to that. We thought that was a really good good step. We don't, as I recall, take that final step of saying about the conflict of interest language that you have and that they cannot serve as a lobbyist. It's good, and that's in our amendments.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steph.
Again, thanks to everyone and the Rochester delegation. We know are working so hard, but folks who have ideas just need to be talking to us because we're going to get this done pretty soon, and it's going to be the 10 of us who are going to make that decision. Senator Spike.
Sure, and Madam Chair, I think as you said, if people have ideas, they need to put it on paper. we need to start seeing this language so we can start wrapping this thing up.
Yes.
Because we're going to get this done, I would believe.
Yes. Thank you. Is there, in the rest of the development items we talked about today, which was Baxter, 3M, Bloomington, South Loop, and Emerson, any conferees have any questions or commissioner or things you want to talk about or different proposals or ideas on any of those projects that we should bring up now?
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
I'm not recalling. I think I raised a question about whether the Emerson project had a had a deadline.
Yes. I think.
And it did. Did we get that resolved?
The Senate does. The House doesn't. And I think we think the Senate has taken the right approach on that. So yes, and we'll have to remember that when we adopt that. Take the Senate date on that. Are there other conferees who have concerns about any of these things or variations we want to talk about? If not, I think we want to get through tobacco. And I think if it's okay, Chair Scoy, I was just thinking maybe not a really detailed walkthrough, but really the House and Senate staffs just telling us what's different here. I think a lot of it is actually the same. So I think we need to really cue up our differences. And of course, we won't know what to do on this proposal till we get a target. But since the governor and the House and the Senate are doing things in tobacco taxes, we could just get through them hearing the difference. I think it would be helpful. Senator Rest.
Chair, if you have questions, Senator Dietzick has been lead on this.
Okay,
so,
great.
She's going to be answering them.
Perfect. So is it Mr. Is and who's best on your staff to join us?
Who did you work with, Nora?
Of course she left. No. Ms. Pollack is... Oh, there she is. We were just hoping to do a little... Oh, Ms. McQuaid, great.
Where is this on the side?
And whoever we think, Mr. Michael, sure. If there's more, please. And we need a side-by-side page to begin, and I don't know if Mr. Biggerstaff wants to start or who. Again, just wanting to kind of understand our differences since we're going to do something here as well.
Madam Chair, on the side-by-side, it's page 22.
22.
And the sections are scattered throughout this, so I'll try to point out where we are.
There it is.
Okay.
So the first section is Section 1, the health impact fee. In both bills, it's the same. Both bills eliminate the health impact fee account and deposit that money into the general fund.
Page 22?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm just, what am I doing wrong?
22.
Here? Article 5, Section 1.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. And then it moves on to the bottom of page 23 is the next section. And that's the cigarette definition. These are similar in both bills. However, the Senate bill does not include the likely to be offered to or purchased by consumers as a cigarette language that the House bill does include in defining cigarettes.
Ms. McQuaid, so we're at the bottom of page 23?
Correct, Section 3. There's a number of provisions that are in the Senate bill that the House has no comparables, and those are plugged in.
Okay.
So we'll kind of jump around a little bit here.
Let's see.
Where did you start?
So we're just trying to look at the definition. Oh, I'm confusing the little scar and the cigarette definition. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, and that speaks to the larger difference between how the House and the Senate characterize little cigars, and it's maintained as a definition under other tobacco products in the Senate bill, and we just reference the text that the cigarette has for the purposes of little cigars.
Okay.
Then
where would you like us to go next?
Moving on, the next section is Section 4, the moist snuff section, and that's the same in both bills. Okay. The next block is the premium cigar provision of the Senate bill. The House doesn't have a comparable provision.
And Madam Chair and members, the Senate defines premium cigar and sets a minimum level at which that can be taxed within other tobacco products. And Sections 18 and 19 refer to that.
Section 5 of the House bill is the other tobacco products. We remove little cigars from that section because they're included in the definition of cigarettes. Section 6 is the cigarette tax rates. The rate changes are different in the bills, but other than that, they're substantially the same. The house increase is a total increase of $1.60 a pack from $1.23 to $2.83 tax in the bill. And the Senate is a rate increase of 94 cents to a total of $2.17.
Okay, excuse me, Mr. Biggerstaff. Sure. Chair Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, so is the cigar differential comparable to what the cigarette differential is in increase? You know, you guys are doing $1.50 or whatever, and we're doing 94. Are the differences in the little cigar taxes the same differential?
Ms. McQuay, do you know, or Mr. Biggerstaff?
Madam Chair, and for the purposes of little cigars, the definition is linked to the rate at which cigarettes are taxed. So,
okay. So yes?
Yes.
You think yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Biggerstaff?
Section 7, then, is the annual indexing. These sections are similar in both bills. The House rounds to a 0.005 for each cigarette, and the Senate rounding is 0.01 per cigarette. And that's the major difference there.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Russ.
So that has a fiscal impact?
Ms. Templin or Ms. McQuay, is there a fiscal impact on the indexing language differences?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Templin.
In that House provision, the indexing, there is a revenue impact with the indexing in the House, with the House language. And it is
it on the spreadsheet?
No, it is incorporated in the cigarette. Well, it is in the spreadsheet incorporated in the cigarette tax increase numbers.
I'm sure it's not a separate line.
That's correct. It is not a separate line.
And is the Senate language have a impact as well? Do they both?
Ms. Madam McQuay. Chair, are you...
They both raise money.
Are you asking in regards to the difference in the rounding, or are you asking in regards to the annual...
Senator Rust?
The difference in the rounding.
Rounding.
Madam Chair, it may be in practice with revenue how it's done. In my conversations with them, this was, and maybe revenue can speak to that, this was a rounding convention, and once you get to that level of detail, it's wrapped up in a line in the spreadsheet. I don't know if we'd be able to identify the difference right now.
Ms. Von Mosch?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first question.
The estimates on the rounding of the indexing on the tobacco taxes. Any insight into how those estimates are?
Madam Chair, I think I would have to talk to someone in tax research in
maybe
order to
answer
that.
They'll talk
question.
To Senator Russ tomorrow.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, it's just curiosity. I mean, why is it different?
This is why we love you, because you're curious about this.
And so, I mean, it's a big difference. The rounding is a big difference. So it's got to have a meaning.
Right.
And the only thing that really means anything around here is a dollar sign. So just curious.
So I think we'd like that answer from revenues.
Madam Chair, we will get that answer for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rest. Ms. McQuay, Mr. Biggerstaff, or Mr. Michael, or I'm not sure who... Section 8, maybe, or is that where we're at?
Yes, Madam Chair. Section 8 is the other tobacco products tax rate. The House bill increases it from 35% of the wholesale price to 95%. The Senate bill raises it to 90% and excludes premium cigars because they have a different rate structure for things that are classified as premium cigars. I don't know.
Ms. McQuay?
Madam Chair, this is also where the... the references to moist snuff come in, as well as the little cigars.
And then Section 9 is the tobacco use tax. The House bill raises that from 35% to 95%, and the Senate again raises it to 90%. Jumping forward then to Section 15 on the bottom of page 25 of the side-by-side.
Excuse me, Representative Norton.
And again, maybe it's just curiosity, but can you explain to me, and maybe it's someone on the Senate side, why you've defined premium cigars differently than everything else?
Senator Dietzick?
What was the rationale for that?
Just a lot of discussion. We just had a lot of, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had a ton of people come in and chat with me, and I've had a lot of, I've been to my little local tobacco shops more in the last 3 months than in the last 10 years. Some of it has to do with the, it was literally a jobs issue from what I got from a lot of the people where a lot of these stores are impacted by the rate increase here because they're, they can come in and it's almost like the showroom type thing. They come in and they sample the premium cigars and then they go buy them online because they're much cheaper online. So it's literally the
Representative Anzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a general question that doesn't need to be answered tonight, but the Senate has quite a few provisions dealing with preoccupation with cigars that I don't understand that. And at some point in time,
Senator Dietzick,
maybe
do you
somebody
smoke?
Can
no, I don't.
Educate
Senator
me a little
Dietzick,
bit.
Are you a cigar smoker?
No,
what's going
not
on
at all.
Here?
It's I.
How about, I could see you with one.
Yeah, no, I lose my voice instantly.
Senator Rusty, are you a cigar smoker? So it's not you two. Senator Coonan, are you a cigar smoker? Senator Senjum, are you a cigar smoker?
Yeah, I almost brought some.
So, Senator Scoy, are you a cigar smoker?
No, but the committee administrator had a baby during the time we were doing this, and he brought cigars. So we thought that it would be good if we would pay a little more attention to him in the bill. But with regard to the premium cigars, there's 8 premium cigar shops left in the state.
Yeah.
And as was indicated, people just go online, and so we thought we would try to preserve those 8 premium cigar shops.
Aren't we fixing that in a different provision? Affiliate Nexus?
Well, you know, there might be progress.
Different. That's a different day. Yeah. When we get to the Affiliate Nexus provision, but okay.
Madam Chair, I didn't ask about you.
I am not a cigar smoker,
okay.
No.
Okay.
Nor am I.
Anybody, any house conferees smoke cigars? Senator or Representative Anzel?
No.
Representative Anzel.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just going to follow up with Senator Dietzick. I've had a number of people come in, and these apparently are small entrepreneurs who are having to face this competition from online sales. And, you know, we're dealing with that in other areas with all our bricks and mortars. Here, this is just an enhanced problem because these entrepreneurs are pretty small business people, and unlike a Target or some company, they're not in the same league to be able to defend their business activities. That's what it's about, apparently.
Okay, so Representative Martin.
Thank you. That got to exactly what I was trying to see here. But no one asked you whether you smoke cigars.
No, I do not. I do not.
So I think we can move on. But thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. Senator Scott.
The other thing, and I don't know if this was mentioned because I might have missed it, but we did – part of the reason that we dealt with the little cigars as we did was so that we could exclude them from the cigarette stamping requirements. And so while they're going to pay the same tax, the stamping requirement isn't there because we had all that testimony about the different size boxes and this and that and the other thing and how if we did this, one of the marketers was going to get market share. And so we thought that it'd try to remove ourselves from that. And so I think it's our Article 4.
We had that testimony, too.
Yeah. So anyway, that was part of our thought, and that's part of the reason all the discussion of the cigars is because we dealt with the little cigars differently.
Representative Damney.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Representative Scoy, or Senator Scoy, pardon me, sir. A chunk of the pushback that I get from tobacco folks on this is that if we increase our tax rates, it'll increase the amount of black market tobacco coming into the state in whatever forms and shapes. doesn't lack of tobacco of tax stamps on the packages make compliance much more difficult for revenue to enforce?
Well, we could ask revenue.
Okay.
Commissioner, like those stamps, or I think we need the tobacco person here tomorrow.
We do. Madam Chair, we should bring a tobacco person tomorrow. We'll do that. We'll bring a tobacco expert. Because it is, you're right, Representative Dabney, it is critical to enforcement to get the stamping at the wholesaler level so that it's already done. But I have to disclose, though, that I'm going to join Senator Sinjim in his office after this meeting when we're done. But we'll get someone from the department tomorrow to answer some of these questions.
Well, Madam Chair, just for the commissioner, then, you're now the tobacco guy, too?
Yeah.
I've got a series of questions, or one big one, of if you carve little cigars out, as the Senate proposes. I remember from past years when I've actually carried legislation related to little cigars, there's a number of points of significance there about pack size and I think minimum pricing and a whole bunch of stuff. I can't bring it all up right now. But if someone could revisit that with us.
Welcome to the committee. What would
you
like us to know?
My name's Pat Finnegan. I'm one of the attorneys in the department. I think as Senator Scoy pointed out, the big difference as far as the little cigars and the stamping would be in the House version. The little cigars are defined as cigarettes, and under our law, if cigarettes have to be stamped, and the stamp for the department, it allows our auditors to go into retail shops because it's an evidence that the tax has been paid. In the Senate version, it's the little cigars are taxed as the same rate as cigarettes, but there'd be no stamping requirement because they're not defined as a cigarette.
Thank you, Mr. Finnegan. Chair Scoy.
Thank you. And Mr. Finnegan, are you currently collecting tax on those unstamped cigars?
Mr. Finnegan.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, we currently collect tax on the cigars, but they're unstamped, and it would be not at the cigarette tax rate. It's the other tax products rate, so it would be a 70%, 30% or 35% excise and 35% health impact fee.
And Mr. Finnegan, are you having a compliance issue with your current tax collections on the little cigars that would be different if the tax changes from what you're currently doing? I mean, you're currently collecting the tax on them.
Mr. Finnegan?
We're just raising the tax.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, I couldn't say that there's no compliance issues. I mean, there are cigarettes and tobacco products that we find in the state that are shipped and are untaxed. So we try to catch that as much as we can. But as far as the stamping, it's easier for our auditors to see that the tax has been paid when they see a cigarette pack that has a stamp on it.
And Madam Chair, my point is that currently they're collecting the tax on these cigars when they're not stamped. I don't think that's a huge issue. And to be honest with you, if we're worried about the black market, we ought not be increasing the tax at all, because it's people from where I live are going to drive in North Dakota to buy cigarettes. I'm here to tell you that that's what's going to happen. And so when you look at the revenue estimates, and I think we had pretty compelling testimony in the Senate committee when I heard this, that many of the revenue estimates are going to fall short because of the black market issue on cigarettes, too, and people bringing cigarettes in from taxes that tax them at a lower rate. But, we're apparently moving forward on this. So.
Well, and, I mean, we can spend maybe more time on that. I do want to hear all the differences, but the revenue estimates from the department include, I believe that, it's one of the few sort of estimates that we see that's dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the whole tax incident study, and it does take in decreased usage, which I'll just say from the House conferees perspective, that's our whole goal here. People don't believe that it's just a way to raise revenue. That really, I think, I was the chief author in the House side Representative Dabney has carried legislation in this for Senator Dietzick, and I can tell you generally authors who are willing to carry these provisions and take the grief that goes with them are committed to the public health argument. And the public, the goal here is to never collect any revenue from these sources because people stop using tobacco. Now, you know, that's utopia, and people will say, well, why don't you just ban them? And, you know, we could try that, then you'd have more black market. But that revenue estimate does take that into account. And you know, I picked $1.60, wanting to go higher, quite frankly, Senator Scoy and Senate conferees, and was convinced by nonpartisan folks that I'd hit that elasticity point that you're just being punitive to people who can't quit. So I picked the number that you can still have people not start or people who are smoking quit. And that really is the goal from the House's perspective. I mean, I don't know what you heard, but the public health testimony in the House on the day we did tobacco taxes is just incredibly compelling. And we just have to get people off this drug. And our Senate conferees know that I smoked in high school, and it is if any of you have smoked or still do, most everybody here, it is really difficult to stop doing that. And we all know people who've died from this drug. And set aside any what you think about that, but the bottom line is we're all subsidizing it, and the cost of this drug in our health care system and our state government costs are just tremendous, and we don't want to pick on smokers. But I do think the revenue estimate and the House really stands by its number. I agree with you on the border city issues. There's no question that's an issue today. And I agree on that there's some black market component. I will tell you personally, I think that's sort of oversold, but maybe it's right. But that's probably true, too, now. And then, as you know, Senator Scoy, probably better than anyone in the room, there's issues on how sovereign nations are using the tax, and that's something that you're the expert on here. But, you know, maybe Senator Dietzick wants to chime in. The public health arguments to me are overwhelming, and I think the public knows this, and that's why the public is so very supportive of increasing the tax on tobacco products. Senator Scoy.
And, Madam Chair, I'll just be real brief. I recognize when I've lost an argument. And I have lost this argument. This is just the way it is. But I think for a lot of folks, adults, and this is different for young people, and so there is probably some benefit to cost when you're young. But for most adults, I don't think it's an economic issue. They're addicted to the drug, and I just tell you, I live in Clearbrook. It's 90 miles from Grand Forks, and people from Bemidji, which is 45 miles farther east than Clearbrook, are going to drive to Grand Forks to buy cigarettes when cigarettes hit $7 a pack in Minnesota. That's what's going to happen.
I do think that's true, and I think it's the net of all the benefits with some negatives. Senator Dietzick, your thoughts on, you know, you're the expert on tobacco on the Senate side. I mean, I don't know how you felt about the revenue estimate, but I think it did try to take those issues into.
I know, Madam Chair, I don't pretend to be the expert on this at all, but one of the things when we came with the price was the discussion with law enforcement on the black market in their concerns of just in that fine line of getting the swamps in from it's not going to be Wisconsin, but from the other side. And so, and I believe they sent a letter to all of us saying that there were some issues, and so I did take that into consideration when coming up with the price.
Thank you.
I believe there is a health, a health issue, but it's balancing law enforcement.
Thank you. Yes.
Just briefly, I would like to say that I did get the quote of the week last year, with regard to little cigars, when we were on the floor of the Senate, and
what is the quote of the week?
Well, the quote of the week at that week was...
this a Senate thing?
No, one of the Rachel Stassenberger or somebody has a quote of the week.
Oh,
okay. I'm not a tweeter or a twinner or whatever.
Oh,
so
tweet of the week. Okay.
It was forwarded to me. But my quote was, and it was with regard to the cherry-flavored, grape-flavored, banana-flavored little cigars, was that... No self-respecting smoker would smoke one of those things.
That's very good. I was a pretty good smoker. Right
now. Oh, you were.
I was even worse.
Yes, there's a lot of former smokers sitting around this table. Mr. Biggerstaff, Ms. McQuay, or others? I'm sorry, Representative Benson.
Well, you know, I'm just interested in, since we're talking about how we can get young people to not start smoking, or how we maybe can reduce how many people are traveling how far to buy cigarettes out of state. Senator Scoy, do you think it makes much difference as far as people traveling out of state to get cigarettes if they pay 94 cents more or $1.60 more?
Senator Scoy.
Well, Representative Chair and Representative Benson, I think we were trying to be consistent with what Wisconsin was having, so we would have less of that border issue. I mean, I don't remember exactly what the percentages are, but I'm going to say 70% of Minnesotans live within 50 miles of the Wisconsin border. I think that's an accurate number.
Okay. All right. Madam Chair, just a little follow-up. You know, you think about these things, and the states among themselves are always competing. You know, come to Mississippi because we only pay $1 an hour, whereas those people in Minnesota are paying a living wage. So come on down here and set up your business here, or we can go to Mexico. Now Mexico is too expensive, so now we're going to go to Bangladesh and build some buildings that collapse and kill people, but we get our clothing for less. I mean, there does get to be a point where public policy needs to be considered, as well as, you know, these other auxiliary problems. That's my point, I guess, with all this.
Thank you. Representative Dan.
Madam Chair, to Mr. Finnegan, I'd asked kind of a big question earlier about what is the significance of pulling the little cigars out as the Senate does and providing them with a different definition. And I'm thinking in terms of things like the unfair cigarette price statute that we have. I know there's the issue of the companies that were involved in the settlement under Attorney General Humphrey and companies that are not, and there's some obligations currently that companies that are not party to the settlement have. There may be some other implications to the Senate approach, and I'm wondering if you can just help us to understand those.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, I think you hit the highlights. If you define a little cigar as a cigarette, then under all the provisions that apply to the cigarettes in our cigarette tax and chapter will apply. So you'll have the same tax. You'll have the fee in lieu of settlement that you mentioned. The pricing statute is not a revenue statute anymore. It used to be, and now it's administered by the Commerce Department, but they would, if we define it as a cigarette, it's going to it would also apply to it. So the difference, I guess, in the House and the Senate, it would tax the little cigars the same as a cigarette, but the stamping provisions, the fee in lieu of, the pricing statutes, none of that would apply, because Under the definition of the statute, they'd still be defined as a tobacco product, not a cigarette.
One last, if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Mr. Finnegan, you may or may not be the right person to ask this question, since you're the revenue guy, but how are the little cigars used? I mean, I think of, I don't know what Mr. O'Rourke brought after the birth of his daughter, but I'm imagining a stogie that I can picture somebody smoking a stogie on, you know, an event like that, or after a big event, or at a baseball game or something. The little cigars, though, I think of as a cigarette, mm-hmm. and by another name. How are they used by consumers?
Mr. Finnegan.
Madam Chair, Representative Daphne, The little cigars would be, I mean, they would be similar to a cigarette. They'd be packaged like a cigarette. They'd look, you know, they're the mm-hmm. same size. They'd look like a cigarette. The traditional cigar that you'd use for a birth of a child, in my mind, would be a bigger cigar. It's not a little cigar. It's a bigger traditional cigar.
Unless it's a little kid.
There we go.
But then not that.
Oh.
Just the bottom one, not the top one.
I'm
cigarette.
Yes, thank you, Representative Ansels.
He's always helpful.
Nice job. I think that's great. I mean, in looking at that, I mean, that just hits, I think your point is well made, Representative Dabney. Now, I don't think people go out and buy those for the celebratory moment, but maybe. I don't know. Don't smoke them.
Going fishing.
Ice fishing.
Ice fishing.
Thank you for bringing that, Representative Ansels. That's, I think it makes the point nicely.
Always trying to be of help.
And we know that. We appreciate that. Senator Dietzick.
So when you went to the public health public health comment, I was thinking, because we did have Senator Gazelka when one of our committees, and I'll bring this up. He said, if we really want to discuss public health policy, why don't we raise the age of smoking like we do drinking?
I support that, too.
Don't do the.
Can we add that to the bill? Can we get that through? Did anybody introduce that as a bill? No, raise the legal smoking age.
We had some creative amendments to ban cigarettes in the state.
Mr. Biggerstaff, Ms. McQuay, Mr. Michael, what did we not hear on the side-by-side? I think we're mostly through it, right?
Madam Chair, members, we're on Section 10, which is a non-settlement fee, which has been briefly discussed. The change is the same in both bills. It goes from 1.75 cents per cigarette to 2.5 cents per cigarette. Section 11 of the House bill is the cigarette sales tax. This changes the in-lieu of the sales or the rate of the tax that is in lieu to include the legacy rate. So it goes from, it includes the 3/8 of 1% in calculating the in-lieu sales tax rate, and the Senate's is slightly different.
Okay, Ms. McQuay, Section 27, page 25.
Madam Chair and members, the Senate reduced the sales tax rate but left this provision alone at 6.5%.
Okay.
Then down page 25 to section 15 of the House bill is the Unfair Cigarette Sales Act, which is the commerce statute we discussed a moment ago. This changes the definition of that statute to include little cigars in that regulatory scheme.
Madam Chair, members, the section 28 for the purposes of delivery, there's a tobacco products definition, and this simply adds the definition of, or adds premium cigars to that definition included there.
Is that everything, or
floor stocks?
Mr. Michael, yes, floor stocks. That's right, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are two more tobacco tax provisions in the House bill. Section 16 is a floor stocks tax, which is the standard provision that's included whenever the legislature substantially increases the cigarette tax. This requires wholesalers and retailers to apply on the date that the cigarette tax changes effective tax to all of the product that they have in inventory that's equivalent to the increase in the tax that applies to prevent them anticipating the increase in buying stock in advance of that. Senate has an equivalent floor stocks tax that, of course, is a key that is keyed to the Senate rate. Section 17 is the last provision, and it provides for the Department of Revenue to make an ad hoc adjustment in the in-lieu sales tax rate. This is the sales tax rate that Mr. Biggerstaff referred to before that the bill raises from the 6.5% to the full 6.875% rate. What this says is that on July 1st of this year, when the cigarette excise tax goes in effect, is to adjust the in-lieu sales tax rate to reflect the assumption that full excise tax got passed forward in prices, in the price of the product. So essentially, the retail price, the average retail price that they assume in calculating that sales tax rate would be raised if the House bill were to pass by $1.60. And so that provides an immediate increase in the revenue from sales tax rate, and it avoids waiting until January 1st when the normal adjustment would occur for that tax rate. Now, the Senate bill in the provision that Ms. McQuaid referred to before actually builds into the statutory language similar adjustments that would be made automatically whenever the excise tax rate is increased. So it's a permanent ongoing provision. One thing I will add to what was said before, that on the indexing of the excise tax rate that's in both bills in a very similar manner, except for the rounding provision that you talked to, one of the effects of that that was not intended is if there was an increase in the federal excise tax, there would be an automatic increase in the Minnesota excise tax. I don't think that when that provision was enacted, that was intended. If the Conference Committee does not want that to occur, we need to provide that price changes that result from a federal excise tax increase do not automatically get included in that indexing adjustment.
Did you know that?
And that obviously was pointed out to us by the industry, since President Obama is proposing as part of his budget excise tax increase, which you can go through the computation and see that if that Congress were actually to enact that, that would automatically increase the Minnesota excise tax by a significant amount.
Think about it. Okay, so the next page.
Then, Madam Chair and members, on page 27, section 46 of the Senate bill is language that requires the Commissioner of Revenue to calculate the cigarette taxes corresponding to the agreement authority with the tribes and make payments for agreements beginning agreements that were put into place for a period after December 21st, 2009. And Senator Skoy may want to speak to this a little.
Chair Skoy.
Well, Madam Chair and members, this is an effort to deal with the issue of the health impact fee for those number of years. And it's a revenue sharing arrangement that the state has. And we're working with the department and trying to get resolution. What we want to have at the end of the day is to have all the cigarettes sold in the state have the state stamp on them. And currently there are two bands that are selling unstamped cigarettes, and they have the legal authority to do that. So we're trying to work this out.
Okay. That helps. Ms. McQuaid?
Madam Chair and members, I believe the next provision would be the tobacco tax collection report, and this is a report that's been requires the Commissioner of Revenue to report to the legislature on the tobacco tax collection system. It's in the same in both bills, and it's been in several tobacco bills that both bodies have heard.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, I believe that the only other piece is the repeal of the health impact fund and the health impact fee.
Mr. Bigger, the repealer on section 50. Are we looking on page 27 and 19?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Section 19 of the House and section 50 of the Senate.
Okay. Mr. Biggerstaff, anything to add?
No.
Okay, Mr. Michael, anything to add?
No.
Any conferees, anything to add on tobacco, or Commissioner or Mr. Finnegan? So I think we know we're going to do something there. I guess I'm trying to think of really what the issues are. It's this definition of the little cigar.
Definition of
the premium cigar piece. Senator Rest, you had.
Madam Chair, I'm just reflecting on the comments made by Representative Benson about where to set the tax increase.
Yeah.
And we didn't make, a huge calculation. We basically accepted the governor's rationale and his rate. And I wonder, why did you have such a higher rate by almost a third than what the governor proposed? Was it just to try and get more money, or was it?
Well,
did you have evidence that at that rate there would be indeed a more dramatic
reduction
health yes. reduction or whatever. And
that was me. I picked that. And, yes, that's why. Mm-hmm. I originally wanted to go higher, and actually it was staff that told me that I would hit the point where
really diminishing
reduction. Yeah, you know, it wasn't an elastic reaction. I think I started out at $1.77. Maybe Mr. Michael can correct me. And I'm trying to remember. I think I looked at $1.77. You know, the advocates in this area who've worked really hard, they were at $1.50. I was trying to go higher because I really was trying to hit the public health impact. And Mr. Michael and Ms. Templin, I think looking at the revenue estimates, thought that was the point of I really wasn't able to make the argument of
after that.
Yeah, and so I went down to $1.60. You wouldn't get any more people to quit. The punitive, you know, and we really don't want to pick on smokers, and I understand that. It's a difficult thing, and it's a regressive tax. There's lots of reasons not to like it, yet the health costs are high, and it really is a user way to collect some for that. So, but that's, Mr. Michael might want to add to that. I mean, that's our Ms. Temple. That's kind of how I think I got to $1.60, and I think $1.77 was, I was talked out of. Mr. Michael, can you add anything to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the thing to keep in mind is sort of the point that Senator Scully was making, that you want to keep this sort of in range with where Wisconsin is. Minnesota and Wisconsin have sort of had a tradition on cigarette tax of leapfrogging each other. And, you know, if you get too much higher than what Wisconsin is, you do have border effects, and as Senator Scully correctly points out, there's a large portion of the Minnesota population that lives very close to the Wisconsin border, and so it's a matter of judgment to say, well, if we're, you know, 20 cents or 25 cents or, you know, something like that more, it's probably not going to create large border effects, but when you get a lot higher, then you will see the same kind of phenomena that Senator Scully is talking about over on the western part of the state.
Others on tobacco, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to touch, to kind of head back and touch on this premium cigar issue, because the affiliate nexus was mentioned. Is that indeed, and I don't know where this committee stands on that particular provision.
It's in both bills, I believe.
Okay, so if that, is this going to be necessary given that, and would the tax impact folks buying online if taxes were made to be equal? Would the tax that we have here then be imposed on the online purchases too, or are we better off maybe just dropping that?
Chair Squire.
Well, I suppose it depends if the cigar seller has nexus or not in Minnesota as to how it would impact it. But isn't that hopefully going to get resolved at sometime at the federal level, and then it will probably not be an issue.
I think it passed the Senate again, or did, but I don't know if it passed the
This would be a question,
House.
Not, Madam Chair, for
Senators.
The department, but the
the excise tax is different
than
the sales
the
tax.
Yeah, the affiliate nexus, I think, is in the sales tax statute, not in
excise.
Not applying actually to excise taxes. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Finnegan or Mr. Michael.
That's right.
I think that's right.
I think
so. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Marketplace Fairness Act that Congress is deliberating and the Senate just passed does relate to general sales taxes, and it does have a requirement that in order – Well, the other thing I will say is that cigarettes are not subject to the sales tax, but cigars are. And so if you have an out-of-state retailer that's making sales into Minnesota that exceed the thresholds under the Marketplace Fairness Act, they could, under that, if that becomes federal law, be required to collect Minnesota sales tax. I would guess, this is just a speculation on my part, that most of these online cigar sellers are not going to have enough sales into Minnesota to trigger that federal law. But if they were, the department would then know, okay, we've got an online seller that's selling cigars into Minnesota. They're required to collect the sales tax. That federal law doesn't require them to collect the other tobacco products tax, so they could, the department could not use that authority to go after them to pay the tobacco products tax. But it very well might be able to get the names of the purchasers from them and then go collect the use tax from,
so right and wrong
from, the, from the buyers, which it does with regard to the cigarette. There's a federal cigarette law that used to be called the Jenkins Act that's been amended that the department requires online or remote sellers of cigarettes to disclose to states the purchasers. And so states are able then to go after, and I suspect many of you members have probably gotten complaints from constituents who have been contacted by the Department of Revenue and been told that they owe cigarette excise use tax on their online purchases. And it's, you know, entirely possible that sort of through this that something like that could happen, but it's in general the thing. The federal law applies to sales taxes and not to other tobacco products taxes, and so it would be circuitous to.
Center rest.
The small seller exemption in the Marketplace Fairness Act is still at. Is it
million.
One or five? Where is it?
It's a million.
Where is it?
And it has an
Andrew
House has the house.
It's at $1 million.
$1 million. It's still. eBay did not get them to raise it. Is that correct?
Unlikely someone would be selling $1 million worth of cigars.
That would be the. So they would not be. So it would not have an effect if we don't do this.
Any other discussion? Chair Skoy, I'm happy to adjourn unless there's something that you. Some small things you'd like to do or. Otherwise, what do you want to do? Any thoughts on tomorrow? Otherwise, I think we just adjourn. Or you got to think about it.
Why don't we look at what we had on our agenda for yesterday, and we can look at some TIF stuff.
We have some provisions with
Right. You know, I think if we look at the very first list we had, and then the second list that we're kind of. You know, not a big deal. We didn't get through all of them. A few. In fact, Center Resin and your conferees held a few that they thought you wanted to look at. So I think we have some little pieces.
That bingo one is weird.
Homes issue.
Education.
A 5-year limit on when carrying it in the inventory. Yeah. Versus, again, you had an unlimited provision.
Right.
The Marshall County flooded farm homesteads.
Right.
And then the floor, assessment changes and valuations on production property. You know, those.
Yeah. We just need to hear what you want to do.
And education. I think we should go through the Senate's education proposal.
We want to learn about that.
I'm sure you can learn about that.
Representative Benson?
Well, Madam Chair, I think tomorrow the House is supposed to caucus at 11 and session starts at noon. I'm just wondering when Senator Skoy wants us to be here.
I think the Senate has posted 9 right now.
Did they? Gee, yes. I don't know.
Getting a nod back there. But should we stay tuned just in case it changes still tonight?
Let's try for 9 o'clock and see if we can get some work done. We also have a provision dealing with aviation fuels that we'd like to talk to the House about at some point tomorrow. See what we can get
done. Is it too early to talk about what we, just for planning, what we think might happen this weekend? Because tomorrow will be the House Thursday, and then the Senate Thursday, we'll be back Friday, and then do we want to?
Well, I was hoping, I've been invited to join the governor in the fishing boat.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Well, that's all right, and I'm pretty sure that we won't be smoking cigars, so that'll be all right.
So. He really wanted to be here, but he has to go fishing with the governor.
But I'm thinking Senator Rest and the rest of the Senate conferees will carry on and hopefully move and act on provisions when I'm not here and would like to go through some of the corporate stuff.
So you didn't want the rest of the senators to be able to go to the fishing opener?
Well, you know, I invited him and I was politely declined. So
did you invite Representative Anzell? Does he get to go and? Representative Benson.
Are you interested? I'm pretty sure there's room in my pickup for you to climb in and make the trip.
I'm going to go ice fishing because I can use 2 lines.
Yeah.
Okay. So you think at this point the Senate will meet on Saturday And then we I think we agreed we're not going to meet Sunday. Is that the
not
plan?
Not on Mother's Day.
Okay.
Was the Senate, was the House, the House is not going to go into session on Saturday. Is that correct?
I think
we heard we were. Then we heard we weren't.
Okay,
I'm
so
not
we
sure.
Would have the opportunity for the conference committee to meet without.
We heard the Senate was going into.
No, we are not.
I think we
Senator
are,
Roots,
actually.
Roots, Mother,
we are. Okay. So.
Do you think we all are on the going to be on the floor on Senate or on Saturday? I thought we were. But I don't know. What have you heard?
I've heard no.
Oh? No, yes. I heard yes. This is how
it
works
vote.
In the House.
Yeah.
Madam Chair,
that was 2 days
I
ago.
Have my monthly coffee hour on Saturday morning in Rochester bright and early, but I could be back here very quickly if you don't start
we're
too early
about
in the morning.
10 o'clock.
And Rep. Some Dabney. I mean, we're
a
just
few
trying
to. Late, but I could get close.
Do we know if the Senate, I mean, do we know if the House is on the floor Saturday?
Yeah, 9 a.m.
Oh, at 10 a.m.
Oh, yeah, 9 a.m., she said. So that could change.
Caucus right away.
It's only
maybe.
Wednesday night. That could change.
Yeah.
But.
That's true. Yeah, but if you go in and caucus for you 5 hours, you could get a lot of work.
I'm with you. I think we can be here instead of in caucus. So, okay.
Let's plan on it.
Okay.
10 o'clock ish or so after you go in and then.
Okay. Anybody else?
We'll
Commissioner?
Does
Commissioner get to go in your boat, too?
Coming up, Myron?
No, I think I've got plenty of work to do back here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes, tomorrow. We should, Senator Scott, we should mention we anticipate a floor session that could be lengthy and that we probably can't leave.
We'll all have to be there. It's the marriage amendment to debate.
So it's going
to
be.
Well, if you get tied up, we'll just pick up the next day.
Yeah. I mean, we'll be able to do morning and night, but the middle
of the day. Sure, sure.
Okay, well, thank you all. We are adjourned.